From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. The website CareerCast recently released their annual list of worst jobs. For 2015, cook was number four. According to this list, the only professionals who have it worse than cooks are lumberjacks, newspaper journalists, and enlisted military personnel. I don't know whether to laugh or cry. It's ironic considering how we glorify chefs in restaurants, but our adoration of celebrity chefs doesn't make life any better for the men and women behind the stove. Last year, journalist and PhD candidate Scarlett Lindemann examined the issue in a piece for First We Feast. It was simply titled, How to Survive on a Cook's Salary. Hi, Scarlett.
Hi.
So, what's the median salary for line cooks who are working in New York City?
Well, for last year, the Department of Labor estimated it at right around $25,000. I mean, that's the median, right? So that's at every level of the spectrum. The restaurant industry is not homogenous by any means. So, you know, every level from fast food all the way to fine dining and everything in between, that's the median, $25,000
a year.
Mm-hmm, correct.
Yeah, I think a lot of times when people hear that, they're shocked.
Yeah, and it's $25,000 a year, and that doesn't take into account the hourly. So line cooks work notoriously long hours. So generally speaking, I'd say 5-hour shifts, 10 to 12 hours, looking right around 60 hours a week. The restaurants that I'm familiar with and restaurants that I have worked in, which are generally at the higher end of the scale, sort of, full service, high-end, relatively ambitious restaurants, I'd say the range is quite a bit higher, maybe $30,000 to $35,000 a year. But if you break that down hourly, that's still around $10 an hour.
So how do people do it? How do cooks and chefs who live in these cities, you're talking about major cities, not really inexpensive places to live, how do they make it work?
I mean, rent is maybe the biggest issue. So living as cheaply as possible, finding the cheapest apartment, which normally means going to the outer boroughs of Bronx, the Queens, Brooklyn, Staten Island, even Jersey City. And I think it becomes increasingly hard to justify the costs of paying exorbitant rent when you're a cook because you spend so many of your waking hours in the restaurant, 60 plus hours a week. So most of the cooks I know are just using their apartments as places to sleep.
Is there a part of the country where you find that cooks are getting paid more than others?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. There was this really interesting report that came out in August by the Economy Policy Institute that found that 40% of all restaurant workers are living at or below the poverty line, with only about 14, maybe 15% receiving any form of health insurance. So, I mean, that statistic's pretty outrageous.
How to Survive on a Cook's Salary. That's the title of Scarlett Lindemann's article on First We Feast. We've got a link to it on our website. Okay, let's move into the dining room. You finished your meal, you had a great time, and then the server drops the check. Is there a more inhospitable moment in the hospitality industry than when you have to calculate that tip? That blank line, it means something different to everyone. But one thing is for sure, people are passionate about the right and the wrong way to tip. For more on this contentious issue, I'm joined by the man who eats out more than anyone else, LA Times restaurant critic Jonathan Gold.
I wrote a column a couple years ago under the guise of 10 rules for tipping. And all the rules came down to tip 20%. And people were absolutely enraged by that. I mean, tip 20% if the service is good, tip 20% if the service is bad. You know, tip 20% if it seems like the waiter is the person who owns the place. Tip 20% if, you know, you're at a restaurant where you have to stand in line and order, and then you sit down and get the food. People like the illusion that they're in charge of that, that they're having an employee for the evening. And there's something about giving a tip, especially if we all agree that basically that, you know, we give a certain amount of money, it lets the owner appear to have lower prices on his menus.
And that's really all – that's really the trade-off.
And it lets the customer feel like he or she has control. And it's like sort of like this useful fiction that lets the process go through. And when the contract seems to be breached on one end or the other end, people go bonkers.
It's interesting. We opened up this the beginnings of a conversation of this on our Facebook page, and people were just outraged that a restaurateur would, in their point of view, make the public pay for their staff. But in effect, when you eat in a restaurant, that is what you're doing. Just like when you purchase any product, you're paying for the sum total of that business's cost of existing, plus hopefully a profit. It seems like only in the restaurant business do we really want to maintain that illusion where we're paying a lower amount of money.
It's true, and it's nuts. Because it might be that in the restaurant business, unlike other businesses, there's that direct relationship between the labor that somebody does and the service that you get. You can see it. It's direct. There are people doing things, and if everybody does everything right, it's magical. And if there's something missing in that chain, then it can be awful. But the idea of tipping is like you're taking out something that the garde-manger did to mess up your salad. You're taking it out on the waiter.
And also, I just feel like, wouldn't it be more likely to actually be magical or be just a simple, good, great experience and a clean exchange if a restaurateur was allowed to charge what he really needed to in order to have a business that thrives?
I think that would be absolutely marvelous. I think that the idea that there are people who are working that hard in that hazardous circumstances filled with extremely sharp things and extremely hot things wouldn't have health insurance, which I'd say almost no restaurants provide, right?
Very, very few. I mean, some now are starting to, and I think that's why they're putting it as that 3% surcharge, because I think they want to make us understand the costs. But then I wonder, as a population of eating out humans, are we really ready to go out and have a $15 simple salad and a $15 simple plate of pasta rather than a $7 salad and a $12 plate of pasta? I'm not talking about a dining palace. I'm just talking about going out to eat. Are we ready to pay those prices?
I would hope that we are. I mean, I know in Australia where the minimum wage is high, $17 an hour, $18 an hour, there isn't tipping. And there's this feeling of democracy when you walk into a restaurant, even a very expensive restaurant, because you know that everybody involved in it, you know, the hostess, the waiter, the people in the kitchen, the guy who schleps in the fish are all making a living wage. It's not that sort of violent disconnect that you get in American restaurants where there are so many people making minimum wage or just above minimum wage in the midst of operation providing luxury.
Okay. Now I'm going to complicate this picture even further and let you in on the restaurateur's side. Labor laws around tipping aren't exactly sexy, but they're important for what we're going to discuss later. So stick with me. If you're a server in states like Wyoming, Texas, or South Carolina, you can get paid as little as $2.13 an hour. That's under the assumption that with tips, you will reach at least the federal minimum wage. In those states, forcing your servers to share or pool tips with the kitchen is illegal, which makes sense because servers depend on those tips to reach their minimum wage. In California, it doesn't work like that. We don't have a tip credit. We're one of seven states where servers make minimum wage plus tips. And I think that most diners assume that these tips are distributed evenly all across the entire restaurant. But guess what? They're not. They're generally not shared with the back of the house. So you have servers making as much as $35 an hour, while the kitchen's making $10. Essentially, you're creating a class warfare between the front and back of the house. The legalese behind tip pooling in California is like a giant riddle. And it's, of course, a concern to restaurateurs who are seeking a more equitable solution. For more, we turn to Bruno Katz. Bruno's a lawyer who works closely with the National Restaurant Association.
What happened in California, it actually didn't start in California, but a case came out in 2010 called Kumbi versus Woody Woo. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals basically said that under the Fair Labor Standards Act, the custom and practice in many states, such as California, is that employers wish to share their tips to all employees in a tip pooling arrangement. They allow the servers, the bartenders, the people who have direct customer service to get more, but they want to let the back of the house people, who are just as important, to share in the tips too. And what the Ninth Circuit said is because California does not have a tip credit, the concerns about not allowing the servers and the people to have direct service with the back of the house to only have those tips does not apply. Now, the Department of Labor felt that that was not accurate and, in fact, passed legislation in 2011, which directly conflicted to the holding in the Woody Woo case.
So the court says it's okay. The Department of Labor says, no, it's not okay. Naturally, this is all very confusing. So a few employers have found some creative solutions to wage inequality. One of them is Ari Tamor, chef owner at Alma, where cooks also serve the food.
Yeah, we like it almost invisible. If we could have matching aprons for the servers, we would do it. But we really love the cooks walking out onto the floor and dropping dishes and explaining dishes and clearing and resetting tables and understanding what it is that the front of house does. And not only it allows for us to tip them because they are essentially participating in service, but it allows them to have a better relationship and a better, deeper understanding of what it's like to have to constantly be present with guests.
According to Bruno, this model's legit.
If you're going to set up percentages in a mandatory tip model, you've got to look realistically at how much contact people have. And if you have a cook and chefs that are having regular contact, you very well can articulate and defend a tip percentage equal to what you would give a server.
At Alimento in Silver Lake, the restaurant chose a different route. Late last year, they added an additional tip line to every check where customers can tip out the kitchen staff if they want. It was controversial, but it's perfectly legal.
The customer then determines how much it wants to give to the back of the house. And that's perfectly defensible, too, because that is a true tip. The customer is making the decision as to how much they want to give to the servers and versus how much they want to give to the kitchen staff.
A third option is replacing tips with the standard service charge. In Northern California, we've seen a handful of restaurants adopt this model in the wake of minimum wage increases, which have already taken effect. One of them is Comal in Berkeley. And like Alma and Alimento here in L.A., creating equity between the kitchen staff and the service staff was really important for Comal's owner, John Paluska. Last year, they ended up switching to a 20% service charge and took the tip line right off the check.
We basically, in short, our philosophy was we're going to reach into our pockets and pay more for labor We're going to try to, as closely as possible, approximate the current income levels of our front of house staff. And then with our back of house employees, we gave them all a significant raise as part of this transition as well to start narrowing the gap.
So for the kitchen, give us an idea, a snapshot of what an average paycheck looked like week one and then week two when the changes took effect.
I would say that on average, people got between a 15 to 20% raise.
So is this service charge also being shared with the kitchen staff?
It's not in any direct way. I'll give you a quick explanation of how we handle the service charge. So the service charge comes in, it's 20% of our revenue, essentially. Half of it goes towards paying higher hourly wages to not just our back of house, but also to our front of house. The other half of it goes into a pool for our service staff. And that is divided through a fairly involved formula between our service and bar team based on the number of hours each of them worked on a given night and how many of them there are, and et cetera, et cetera. And we publish that information on a Google Doc spreadsheet that they can access immediately at the end of every night. We settle out each night. They know exactly what they made in the revenue share. So they have a base salary and a revenue share portion, which allows them to feel like they have more vested interest in a busy night, that they're not getting the same regardless of how busy they are. The difference is that it shows up in their paycheck every 2 weeks instead of every night.
Now, I understand that the system in one town over, in Oakland, is different, that they have a portion of the new municipal law which defines exactly where a service charge should go.
Yeah, in that ballot measure, it was language that specified that the service charge could not be retained in any way by management and needed to be distributed to those who, quote, provided the service. We don't have any big problem philosophically with that because we know that the entire service charge we're collecting is going to our hourly staff. But the problem is the accounting for it. It's complex and somewhat vague as to how you're supposed to demonstrate that. And I think some of the restaurants just got a little spooked by that language. So they made a leap right to all-in pricing.
And by all-in pricing, you're referring to a menu price that just simply reflects the total restaurant cost.
That's correct. What you see includes all of the service you're being provided. You're not expected or asked to provide service charge or a tip or anything. They've incorporated that into the menu pricing. I think with mixed results, my impression thus far is that check averages are lower.
I understand that Daniel Patterson's more casual restaurant, Aster, went all in and then had to back away.
That's right. And theirs is an interesting situation because they went all in from the start. So they didn't change from one system to another. But I guess even in their case, they decided that it wasn't working. It's complicated. As much as I think a lot of people are ready to move past tipping, the reality is it's that paradigm, that model, that payment structure of paying for your meal and then adding a tip on top is so ingrained in people. That's why we chose to go to a service charge rather than all-ins, because it more closely mirrors what people are doing anyway. I mean, we had an average gratuity of 20%, so all we did was make it automatic, which gave us the ability to use that money to help balance some pay inequities. And as the minimum wage keeps rising, if we hadn't done that, the only people who get the raise are the people in the service staff who are already making the most money. But, you know, there's certainly a zeitgeist shift emerging here in the midst of all this minimum wage stuff to take a really good look at tipping and a lot of the unsavory aspects of it and the manipulative aspects of it and the discriminatory aspects of it and the sexist aspects of it.
Are you talking about, for example, sexual harassment of female servers?
Yeah, that's probably
servers.
The obvious one. Yeah. It's not just female either. It goes both ways. I mean, we have male servers who, you know, a gang of gals will be out for a night, you know, gals night out, and they'll cross some of the same lines with our male servers, you know. I think it's less threatening to them, but it's still harassment.
Have you heard from your staff already that they feel a lack of this?
Oh, yeah, especially the females on our staff. And they're like, oh, my God, it's such a breath of fresh air. This is so much better work environment for me.
Because they're not having to do that flirtatious dance to try and get the best tip possible.
Yeah, and I don't even say if it's a flirtatious dance or just endure as much. I think it just changes the dynamic. The people don't have this sort of sense that they can behave badly because they've got this person in a situation where they're dependent on them providing a big tip at the end of the whole experience, you know?
I just think it's graceful. It allows the whole experience to be hospitable to the end.
Well, that's our hope, and that's our goal.
John, thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
That was John Paluska. John is one of the owners of Komal in Berkeley. Coming up, what does all of this talk mean for Los Angeles? A minimum wage increase is on the table here in LA, and with that comes fear, excitement, and a lot of uncertainty. How the restaurant world is coping. Next.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food. Talk about tipping versus service charges in today's changing restaurant economics is not an easy task. There are a ton of moving parts that involve the following. Are we talking about a neighborhood diner or a high-end restaurant? Is the restaurant doing $500,000 a year or $4 million? Are there 10 employees or 100? How do you craft a minimum wage bill that will be fair to tipped restaurant and nail salon workers and owners? To navigate this crazy landscape so we can have a better understanding as consumers, we turn to journalist Jean Mattis, who just wrote a piece for the LA Weekly about this hopeful mess.
Thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you. And it is one, it's so interesting because it is one of the most complex subjects that we've ever covered.
Yeah, and no two restaurants are alike, right? So you could be talking about a very high-end restaurant which might have a totally different business model from McDonald's or a restaurant that's in between. So there's a huge diversity, and the sort of policy has to fit everybody in some way.
And I think one of my favorite parts of the article that you wrote for the LA Weekly was that you got real human with it, and you actually interviewed workers at both Cantor's and Bestia, which I thought was great because these are two completely different places. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what the workers shared with you?
Sure. So I think at Bestia, one of the key issues there was the huge disparity between front and back of the house. So at the front of the house, people, they're all, you know, young, they're in their 20s or 30s, they're many of them college educated, and they're all making $35 an hour probably, and, you know, which is a very good living for somebody who's in their mid-20s. They're making minimum wage plus tips. They don't see themselves needing a raise necessarily. But if you go to the back of the house, we're dealing with kitchen employees who are making maybe $10 an hour, and they very much do need a raise. And so they're sort of wrestling with how do we deal with this policy and address the inequities that exist between front and back. Something like Cantor's, everybody is sort of in the same boat in a way where nobody's really getting rich at Cantor's. You know, the back of the house at Cantor's is making maybe $9 an hour. But the waiters and the wait staff are probably not doing very well either, $35,000, $39,000 a year, something like that, including tips. So nobody's really getting rich off of Cantor's, and so they had a much different approach to it. It was, you know, but everybody's also sort of adapted to the system that exists, too, and so everybody's a little worried about, you know, if something changes and it affects the business model of the company that I work for, is that going to affect me somehow in a negative way?
Yeah, they seem to be much more concerned with the possibility that owners would lay people off and then they would have to do many jobs instead of one job.
Right. So the restaurant owners, I think we could say pretty much across the board, aren't really thrilled about this idea. But it's all kinds of, depending on what kind of restaurant you're running, it's a very different picture in terms of what you might do to adapt to this. So at a place like Cantor's, the thing they're 24 hours. One of the things they're talking about is maybe we're not going to be 24 hours anymore. Maybe we're going to close at night, at least on the weekdays. A place like Bestia is a very different situation. They're thinking, we have tips now. If we switch it to a service charge, then we can distribute that between front and back, and that would address the problem there. So there's a whole bunch of different remedies that people can come up with to adapt to this, and it depends on what kind of restaurant you're talking about as to what people are going to do. You know, price increases would be one, but layoffs, cutting hours, service charges, there's all sorts of different things happening out there.
Now, this campaign on behalf of a lot of restaurant owners to the city council to make tips count, what has been the response of the mayor to that?
So the mayor has said that he agrees with them, that he sees the logic that if somebody's making $25 an hour, including tips, that that person isn't the kind of person you're trying to help with a minimum wage increase. However, what he has told the restaurant community is, look, this is a state issue. This is state law that affects this. My hands are tied. I can't do anything to help you. You need to go talk to Sacramento. The restaurant community doesn't agree with that. They think that the city could, if it wanted to, set the rules for its own local minimum wage. And if the city wanted to include total compensation, which is something that's been done in Seattle, that it could do that. And then the question would be, you know, what would happen if somebody sued over that? Would it stand up in court? But the mayor, so far at least, has not been willing to sort of take that risk that it might not stand up in court.
I feel like there are the camp of labor activists who are in full force, obviously, supporting the minimum wage. And a lot of this also gets into the world of wage theft, because people worry that if the minimum wage is raised so much, so fast, that people will find a way to underpay employees.
Yeah. And certainly there are people who are not making the minimum wage now, right? And so, you know, if you increase the minimum wage, then there will be more people who are being paid under the actual minimum wage. And so the real issue is, at a certain point, how do you enforce the minimum wage law that you're passing, right? Because a certain percentage of people will follow the law, a certain percentage of people will not. And so one of the big points for the activists has been $15 an hour and enforcement. We want some kind of effort on the city's part to have investigators and auditors and so on who, when there's a complaint made, can go into a restaurant and look at the books and see if people are making $15 an hour or whatever the minimum wage ends up being or not. And so far, there hasn't been much from the city in terms of a commitment to actually enforce the law and to put money behind enforcing the law. And so that would leave it up to the state, which is currently responsible for it. And, you know, ask any activist about it and they'll tell you the state doesn't have the resources to go in and do this kind of work on an intensive basis. So that's been one focus for the activist community is trying to figure out, okay, you say it's $15, but how do you make sure that people are actually getting $15?
One of the things we haven't talked about before is this sort of unique place that LA restaurants have been able to develop, a place where there has always been a very large immigrant pool of labor willing to work for low wages, and that perhaps this is one reason why we've been able to have such a dynamic restaurant scene, especially at the more casual end.
Yeah, you could definitely look at it as the diversity of restaurants that exist in LA and the great restaurant scene that LA has is in some way subsidized by low-wage work and subsidized by people who are willing to make $9 an hour. Now, if you talk to people who are making $9 an hour, they'll tell you that they're happy to have a job and happy to be making $9 an hour, most of them. It takes actually a pretty unusual person to complain about that kind of scenario. But when you think about it, you know, the back of the house, it's, you know, are making a very small wage for the, and the whole restaurant industry is dependent on that work. So you can certainly see the argument for saying, you know, these people need to be making 13, 15, whatever it is. And that's, in fact, the restaurant community has been basically agreeing with that position and saying, okay, we'll agree, we'll pay our back of the house 13, 15, and they've taken that issue off the table and solely focused on the front of the house issue and the tip issue.
When do you think we can expect a vote?
I was told maybe middle of May. That was a couple of weeks ago, so it might be the end of May or maybe even June at this point.
And do you think the vote is going to be on bills that have currently been written, or do you think the language is going to change?
I think they're still figuring out what the final language is going to be. You know, if I had to guess, I'd say it's probably something like $15 an hour by maybe 2020. The mayor's proposal is $13.25 by 2017 with a cost of living adjustment. Some of the council members have said, no, let's go to 1525 by 2019. You know, it's probably going to end up being a compromise. If I had to guess at this moment, I'd say that the total compensation thing will not be in it because I haven't heard anybody in a position of power who's really advocating for that. And the argument has been basically that the city's hands are tied and there hasn't been, you know, a breakthrough in terms of figuring out a way to do it locally. So if I had to guess, I'd say that it's probably going to end up being, you know, an across-the-board kind of thing.
So if total compensation ends up not being included in a law, in the law, do you think we're going to see just service charges taking over in a large part of the fine dining, upscale casual dining scene?
Certainly there's some places that can do that. I think we're just going to see a lot of different steps that different restaurants are going to take to adapt. And some places will cut staff and some places will cut hours and other places will close down probably. Some places will raise prices. And, you know, it's easy to sit here and sort of be a bit of a Chicken Little about it and say, oh, my God, it's going to destroy the industry. I think most of the restaurants out there will figure out something that will allow them to continue to function. But it'll be in a different way, and they'll have to figure out how to adjust to a new reality.
Well, Gene, thank you so much for writing such a thoughtful and thorough piece for the LA Weekly.
Thank you.
That was journalist Gene Mattis. We've been talking about all the different moving parts pertaining to the proposed minimum wage law. Whew! Let's take a break from all this legal talk and get some food in our belly, shall we? Jonathan Gold's back in the studio next with a look at Empress Pavilion in Chinatown.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food. Jonathan Gold's back in the studio with me now, this time for a restaurant review. You know him. He is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. And this week, we're going to Chinatown, to a restaurant I've been to many a time.
We're talking about Empress Pavilion, which was sort of the giant Cantonese, Hong Kong-style banquet restaurant that was built at the height of the 80s boom, which has been sort of way under the radar for the last decade or so. The mall was dead. The escalators weren't working anymore. The dining room was empty. When it closed, nobody noticed that much.
Well, I think actually it was kind of a sigh of relief that it actually closed because watching that downward slide of that whole property was kind of sad.
Yeah. Although it must be said that people had been saying that Empress was going downhill almost from the day that it opened. I remember like going through endless chowhound discussions about how bad it had become and then going and having like a dish of Dungeness crab with garlic and pan-braised noodles. It was one of the best things I've ever had.
I mean, I think when you're a 600-seat place, you're a big target, right?
You're a huge target. And when you're a 600-seat restaurant, you are a lot of things to a lot of people. You do the big banquets. You know, big parts of you are closed off for, you know, wedding parties or confirmations or business lunches. You're endlessly configured. And sometimes a lot of the focus goes to the, you know, elaborate banquet menus instead of perhaps to the stuff that you might get if you inadvertently stumbled in there on a Friday night.
And I just remember the dim sum, the weekend dim sum lines, just sort of legendary.
Oh, formidable. You'd sometimes wait a couple hours. And if it's taking that long and you're turning a 600-seat restaurant that many times, you become like almost less a restaurant than you do sort of a major cultural institution.
So how long has it been closed?
It was closed about a year. It reopened last fall under the aegis of the people who own Ocean Seafood, which is another big place in Chinatown, just a few blocks away, which was the site of Miroa, which is probably the first like really, really good dim sum place in LA.
So over this arc of time of when Empress was really pumping out the business and now, so much has changed.
Well, yeah, Chinatown is no longer the focus of Chinese life in Southern California. It's not even close. And when people go to dim sum, they always ask, you know, hopefully, do I have to go to Monterey Park? And the answer is, yeah, kind of you do. You know, there's a lead in Monterey Park. There's King Juan Alhambra. There's Sea Harbor in Rosemead. There's so many of, like, the big places that do super high quality stuff. It's actually worth the extra 10 or 15 minutes on the road.
Having said that, now that it's reopened, tell us your experience at Empress Pavilion.
The first time I went in was odd. I mean, it was like really like, you know, sweet and nostalgic, you know, paying for parking, driving up that really long ramp to this parking structure, which is actually above the mall, seeing the sort of secret Zen garden like hidden behind the elevator tower that's been there forever, and then walking down to the level. The escalator was working again. The sign is gleaming. The food dogs out front look as if they'd been specially clean. You know, walking to the restaurant, being greeted, being let in, and realizing that the room was entirely empty.
You were the only party in a 600-seat restaurant?
Yes.
And you stayed?
And I stayed.
Because I would imagine your first impulse would have been to run.
Yeah. Among the group of friends that I was with was a Chinese woman who I think had been under the impression that I was going to take her to Sichuan Impression or Chengdu Taste. It was – she was sore. And you sit down and they hand you a menu, and the menu is ocean seafood. They don't even like try. And
it says ocean seafood on it?
Yeah. And as I always do, you know, I order a steamed fish. I'm sorry, no fish. It's a seafood restaurant. You know, I asked if they had duck and they didn't have duck. I asked if they had the house special roast chicken and they said no. And they said, hold on, I think maybe we could do a fried chicken. And they came back and they said that they could. They said that they had a crab. Would I like the crab?
They had a crab.
It was a $110 crab. It was a really expensive crab. They upsold us on the crab so totally. But
was it a good crab?
The food was actually good. I mean, every warning sign was there telling you to flee, except it didn't have that weird bad restaurant smell. Everything was really bright and fresh and clean. The waitresses and waiters didn't look depressed. It just was a restaurant that didn't happen to have any people in it at the time. And, you know, the sautéed pea tendrils with garlic were genuinely good, and the big, you know, Dungeness crab done with ginger and garlic was good. The squid deep fried with pepper salt was like crisp and sort of melting inside and had a nice spice to it. I mean, it's clearly a pretty good restaurant that might be literally 10 times bigger than it needs to be on some nights.
Are they still doing banquet business?
They say they're still doing banquet business, and it's still a good banquet room. And they apparently did a $2 million kitchen remodel, which is huge, right?
Yeah, let me pick my jaw up off the table.
So I assume it's here to stay, and I assume that at the point where it picks up, it's going to pick up. Going for dim sum in the morning, there were people there. It was maybe a third filled as opposed to being completely empty. They still had the sort of loud soundtrack of Kenny G or somebody who sounds very much like Kenny G doing, like, you know, Cantonese hits of the 90s. It has carts if you know, miss a day where dim sum came from carts instead of ticking off things on lists. And you're going to eat better dim sum in the San Gabriel Valley if you go to the top five places. But if you're downtown and you want to go to Chinatown and, you know, look out and see downtown skyscrapers and Dodger Stadium and, you know, the streets of Chinatown and eat, you know, barbecue pork buns and congee rice porridge with thousand-year egg and, you know, chongfun, the steamed rice noodles wrapped around shrimp, you know, you're going to do okay.
Thank you very much.
So glad to be here.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Empress Pavilion in Chinatown. If you text the words good food to 69866, you'll get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Or you can just find it on the Good Food restaurant map, which lives on the Good Food blog. KCRW thanks the Flora L. Thornton Foundation for its generous support of Good Food. A story broke earlier this week about an intensive restaurant delivery service. Why is this news? Well, Maple, as the service is called, has 22 kitchen workers, 35 delivery people, but no actual restaurant. It's like the there that there is where you are. Momofuku's David Chang is attached to the venture, as is the investment amount of $22 million. Issy Lepowski's a staff writer at Wired, where she covered the story. Hi, Issy.
Hi.
This is just such a bizarre story for me, a person who had a restaurant of which 35% of sales were deliveries.
Right, exactly. I mean, the interesting thing is that how much of your overhead was from the actual running of the restaurant itself. That's what these people are trying to cut out right here. By not running the restaurant itself, they actually eliminate a lot of the cost of running a restaurant.
But what's also fascinating to me is the investment in the back of the house, the kitchen. This is a very large staff and a very large commitment of the number of delivery people. So why don't you lay out the scene for us, both in terms of the food that's being prepared and how it's getting to the people?
Sure, absolutely. Well, Maple has basically started this delivery service only in the financial district of Manhattan. They're trying to sort of force a lot of density. So if they were serving the entire island of Manhattan or all the boroughs, their business model might be a lot more difficult. But now, for now, they can actually promise you pretty quick delivery because their kitchen is down here and they have this staff at the ready. And you're right, 35 delivery people, that's a lot, and they probably have about 18 working per shift. The idea is they don't want to mess this up. They don't want to run out of enough people to make their delivery service delightful for the customer. So they've almost overhired to start because they're predicting a lot of growth. And they know that they have a little bit of flexibility, being that they are a tech startup, that they can dial back or dial up as they need to. And basically the way the model works is they have this kitchen in the financial district now, and in every new neighborhood where they open up service, they will have a kitchen and an entire staff there, and then they'll have delivery that only serves that area. But what makes this really all work is the technology behind it, because it works very differently than your typical restaurant would. It does a lot of predictions. So the kitchen staff and the delivery people don't have to decide, you know, what's the best route to travel or which order needs to go out first, who's been waiting the longest. The technology sort of makes a lot of those decisions for them, and it learns over time what the best decisions are to make.
Okay, so David Chang is attached to this venture. So one imagines that the food is of extremely high quality. Given that there's no physical space in which you're adding value to the food by decor and tabletop, your service utensils, how are they expressing that in the way the food is situated in boxes, for example, for delivery?
The founders thought a lot about that. You know, they were talking about how restaurants, you can have the most gorgeous restaurant, and if you order delivery, no matter what, you're going to get it in an iHeart New York bag, and there might be grease, and it's not carrying with it all the decor that the restaurant is really known for. So they thought, you know, how can we recreate that if we're delivery only? And really, truly, if you order from Maple, you will see it's a completely different experience. First of all, it comes in this beautifully packaged brown bag. It's almost like a shopping bag. It's got really subtle but sophisticated branding. It comes with two boxes inside that are smaller than you would usually get because they don't want the food to shift around in transit. They separate out the main entree from the sides. So you really get something that's still fresh. It's still compact. You know, the sauce is where it should be and all the food is where it should be. Comes with a little silverware, plastic utensils in a little also Maple branded paper wrapping. So really they've thought a lot about, you know, how to make this a more pleasurable delivery experience. And they're actually now going to the lengths of designing their own packaging because what they found that was off the shelf isn't up to their standards quite yet.
What is the price point of all of this?
Sure. That's another really big selling point of Maple is their price point. They charge $12 for lunch, and that includes delivery and tip, and $15 for dinner with delivery and tip. And that's really crazy. I mean, especially in New York City, you can order, and these meals you're getting are, it's, you know, an entree of fish and two sides. To order that from any New York City restaurant, it's going to be $25, not to mention adding in a delivery fee and a tip. So you really are getting a cost savings here. And again, that's because they've been able to cut so much cost off the top.
So are they running the menu like some of these sort of diet delivery services where there's just X number of choices? It's not like you're ordering a la carte off a large menu.
Exactly. That business model of diet delivery services probably is the closest to what they're doing, except I think they would balk at that because their food is a lot better and in some cases a lot less diet friendly. But yes, so they will offer three options for every meal, and for dinner they all have an entree and a side. And the food really is high quality. And again, they're able to source a lot better ingredients, and I think David Chang had a big hand in that, in telling them, you know, what are the freshest foods and what are the ones that are sustainably raised. I know they told me that they were interested in having salmon on the menu, and David Chang said, you know, unless we can find an affordable, sustainably raised salmon, we're not doing that. So I think he's had a lot of influence in the quality of the food, and so they're able to source better ingredients because they have lower overhead on the overall physical footprint.
Okay, so now we have to get around to money, because one of the fascinating parts of this whole paradigm is the huge amount of the investment. $22 million, describe to me what they're trying to build.
I think they're trying to build, basically, as they called it, restaurant 2.0. What would a restaurant be if you didn't have a restaurant? And, you know, they ran a bunch of like Chipotle's sort of economics past me, and they said, you know, Chipotle is doing a certain amount of business just in the portion of Manhattan that's below 42nd Street, and their economics look a lot better because they actually don't have to have the front of the house, so they could serve that entire area with a much smaller physical footprint. Chipotle is obviously a huge company, so imagine now you're spreading this to other cities around the country. It could really be a big business. And, you know, one of their investors, who's also a co-founder, said, I think that this could be a billion-dollar business in Manhattan alone. The restaurant industry is huge here. If you really are creating the next hot restaurant, it just doesn't happen to be a restaurant. It can be a really big business.
So fascinating. It's going to be really, really interesting to watch this unfold.
Definitely.
Thank you so much, Issy.
Great. Thank you.
Issy Lepowski is a staff writer at Wired, where her story on Maple first appeared. Up next, California papayas. It's the latest fruit to show up at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Let's go now to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where Laura Avery delivers her weekly report.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. You know, for years, people wondered why we didn't have papayas at the farmers market. We do have Mediterranean and tropical climate zones all over the state. We're happy to say now we do have papayas at the farmers market through Golden State Papaya. It's a small papaya ranch in Carpinteria, co-owned by Damian Rocchino and Adam Rhodes. And it's an experimental plot, and it's producing delicious papayas. So, Damian, here you are starting at the Wednesday market. You also sell in Santa Barbara when you have enough papayas. So tell us about your papaya growing program and what kind you have.
Our papaya growing program consists of everything we use are organic products. We're not certified quite yet. There's a process. But we really only use about four products. I can't really tell you yet, but it's really simple. They're really hard to grow. It took us a few years to figure it out, but we're finally at market, and it's really exciting.
So you're the one who lived in Hawaii and realized that there was a market for them over here. And don't most papayas we get now in the country come from either Hawaii or somewhere outside the country?
Yeah, everything's pretty much brought in through Hawaii, Brazil, or mostly South America. Hawaiian varieties are definitely a different type of flavor. You've got a lot more tropicals. The Brix levels, which are the sugar levels in the fruit, are much higher. Most people in the United States are used to eating Mexican varieties, which are like the Meridol. It's the big ones that you normally see in the grocery stores. They're a completely different fruit. And once people try the Hawaiian ones, they're excited.
So yours are the Hawaiian ones. And what varieties are they actually?
They are the Solo Sunrise and Solo Sunset.
Right. And the sunset and the sunrise basically look identical on the outside, but the flesh is different, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't tell. All papayas pretty much look the same. So we have to mark them from when they're seed all the way to harvest and keep the bins separated. But once you do cut inside, you'll definitely see a color difference. And the sunset, which we also known as strawberry papaya in Hawaii, tend to have a bit more darker, pinker flesh and more floral notes.
Okay, and your production now, you got a small production facility. How many pounds are you able to harvest a week?
Right now, we're kind of ramping up. I think we did about 700 pounds this week. Pretty excited. Normally, we're only doing about 300. So we pretty much doubled this week. And I think throughout the summer, we're going to double, triple, maybe quadruple. And then we'll kind of be at a peak there. And then it will dwindle towards winter. But we'll still be producing in winter. It's kind of an ebb and flow type of production. We're just planting out two more acres, and we're just going for it.
And these are all in greenhouses?
They are in greenhouses. That's all I can reveal.
Oh, okay, but not the secret secure location. Okay. Is that because they're so incredibly sensitive?
You know, it's funny. They're a true tropical. When I say true tropical, a lot of people try and say that California is a subtropical type zone. It kind of is in theory, but I still think it's a much colder climate than most people think. The papayas sit in Hawaii, and they don't really change much than about 5 to 10 degree temperature night difference. And they just pretty much day and night are the same there.
I know. I went to the farm, and you told me they're so picky, and there's like 15 different things. And if you don't do every single thing, they just refuse to fruit.
They're a funny tree like that. They're like exponential growers. So if you make one mistake, it's like times 10. So it will go and just stop on you. If you do everything right, you get well rewarded with fruit and phenomenal flavors. No one's been able to figure it out in California. And it took us 3 years. And now it's just every single day of just tinkering and playing around. And that's how we finally did it after 3 years.
Yeah. You're really babysitting those trees.
Yeah, they are a finicky, finicky crop. Yeah.
So, Damian, with your expanding greenhouse, are you planning on growing some other tropical type fruit?
Yeah, the last 3 years we've been experimenting with all kinds of fun things. We've have 6 varieties of bananas coming out. They'll still be in a limited supply at first, but we're ramping up. They're great flavors. You forget what a banana actually tastes like when you pick it that day off the tree and eat it. It's completely different, and I think most people in America have never actually had a real banana.
So true, yeah. What else?
We've also had pineapples. They're really cute. They're about a half the size of your normal commercial pineapple, but the flavors are there. They're really cute. I can't wait till everyone sees them on the display unit. They'll blow people away, probably more than the papayas, honestly.
Okay. And will that be this year?
I think one more year.
Okay.
Until we can actually supply consistently. So we're right now, we get to eat them.
Yeah, I was going to say, you get the best job right now. Yeah. Okay.
We also have in the works, we're playing with Suriname cherries. Most people don't know those. We've got three different passion fruit varieties that no one's ever seen. So there'll be a lot more coming.
Okay, well, this is so good to know. And it's great that you're out there being that creative pioneering farmer who's going to bring all this tropical stuff to California.
Thanks so much, you guys. It's been a pleasure.
All right, Damien, thank you so much. That was Damien Riquinio. He's the co-owner of Golden State Papayas based in Carpinteria, bringing us papayas now and more tropical fruit in the future. I'm talking now with Jerry Sue, who's the chef at Eagle Rock Public House. He's here shopping today, getting inspiration at the market, got a cart loaded. So, Jerry, tell us what you're shopping for.
A little bit of everything. I mean, I come out here twice a week to do most of our shopping for the restaurant, so about 95% of our produce comes from here. One of the things I have in my cart today is stinging nettles.
And what are you going to make with those?
We do a stinging nettle chimichurri that goes along with our smoked fried chicken leg.
Oh, and tell us how the proper way is to handle them when you first pick them up off the table till you cook them.
I guess first thing I would suggest is maybe gloves. They are, you know, stinging nettles. It's part of the name. So they do make you a little itchy, but it's not going to kill you. So we just kind of take the leaves off the stems, give them a quick blanch and a shock in some ice water. And then we blend them up in a food processor with some other herbs, garlic, olive oil, and then some Calabrian chilies. And then we add some acid on pickup in form of white vinegar and lemon juice.
And how do you describe the flavor of stinging nettles?
Well, they're green leafy sort of vegetables, so you get a lot of nice kind of earth tones out of there, but they play really nicely with acid, I find. Works well in the chimichurri.
Yeah, and they seem to grow wild. Don't a lot of people forage for those too?
Yeah, that's kind of one of those things that grows up and down the state, similar with like a wood sorrel or nasturtium. That's kind of one of those California natives that you'll see up and down the state.
So, Jerry, how do you use the chimichurri? Is it an after as a dressing? Is it a marinade or what?
We use it as an accompaniment to one of our dishes, but you can use it as a marinade. I've seen people do stuff like that. But for us, it's just kind of more like a sauce that we put on the plate.
And when you're done blending and pureeing, is it kind of thick?
It's similar to like a pesto. So a lot of blended herbs and some olive oil. So it has kind of like a pesto consistency.
And you could probably use throughout the year almost any herb you come across.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, with this sort of recipe, that's a nice thing. Depending on what kind of flavor profile you want, you can substitute with any variety of herbs.
Okay, but what is the standard, though, flavor? Is there always one sort of signature herb that goes in there?
Probably typically parsley and cilantro are kind of the most common. We put a little bit of mint and a little tarragon in ours.
And the stinging nettle.
Right.
Oh, that sounds so good. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That was Jerry Sue. He's the chef at Eagle Rock Public House, enjoying being here at the market, as we all are every single week. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
If you missed any part of today's show, listen whenever you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find us on demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Thanks to everybody who works on Good Food. That is Jillian Ferguson, Laro Garcia, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back here next week with more Good Food.